The good news here, I think, is that it doesn't seem like a new asset class to many of our, you know, CFOs and others on university campuses. It's accepted as something that we do. I think that's highlighted by Brad and his colleagues, you know, working at University of Washington, Seattle. You know, Jeremy, if we go back to the 2000 aughts, which, you know, when we got into this business, there was no way that the University of Washington, or you got your project with RISE over at UT Knoxville, or a project I worked on with ACC at University of Michigan, those are three schools that wouldn't have come out of our mouths, right? And so I think that to me, it's really reflective of the acceptance of P3 and campus housing, and it's not really new and innovative. It's just what folks are doing as a function of the way that their universities operate.
This episode of the Student Housing Insight Podcast is sponsored by The Guarantors. If you're an operator, you know the importance of a parental guarantor. Having parental guarantors legitimizes your rent roll. But have you ever tried collecting from a parental guarantor after their student skips out or they have to be evicted? How quickly were you able to recoup lost rent from that parental guarantor? The truth is, if things get to a point where a student skips out or is evicted for non-payment, the parental guarantor doesn't care about their credit score. There may have been a job loss or even a divorce. No background check is going to tell you which parent is about to leave their spouse or has an employer who is about to downsize. So how do you eliminate that risk? I mean, reducing risk is like the top three responsibilities of a property manager. Well, the guarantor's rent coverage product does just that. Not only will it ensure that you can quickly recoup lost rent, but it will also increase your prospect to lease conversion rate because you're not waiting on a parent to provide their information. This product makes so much sense for student housing assets, and that's exactly why I'm now advising my asset management clients to forget about parental guarantors and talk to The Guarantors. You can find more information about their rent coverage product as well as other risk reduction products they provide to the student housing industry by going to theguarantors.com/student. You can also find the link in the show notes. Welcome to the Student Housing Insight Podcast, where we are connecting you to everything that brings student housing to life. I'm your host, Wesley Dees. I'm also the CEO and founder of Student Housing Insight. That's correct. We're not just a podcast, but we are a platform for off-campus student housing professionals to network, learn, and share ideas and data. So for more information on content or events and even industry jobs, yes, our website now has a job board. Go check it out at studenthousinginsight.com. By the way, the job board is still in beta, but we've got some great companies that have open positions listed there. If you want more information about how your company can post openings, email us at contact@studenthousinginsight.com and we'll get you set up. Okay, today's episode is all about the world of public-private partnerships within the student housing industry. In March's Shop Talk, I got a chance to sit down with three gentlemen who work for some of the most active P3 providers in the space to kind of get an outlook on how that side of our industry is doing. The conversation and the information was really, really good. So good, I wanted to share it with the podcast audience as well. And I know, there is overlap between our Shop Talk audience and the podcast audience. And if you caught the conversation on Shop Talk, it's probably worth listening a second time. I know for myself, just editing that portion for this podcast, I caught a couple of things that I didn't catch, during the interview of these three guys. So give it another listen. I think you'll probably catch something you didn't catch the first time around. And if you are new to the podcast and you have no idea what Shop Talk is, Shop Talk is the industry's monthly webinar focused on student housing operations. That's where the shop part of Shop Talk comes from, student housing ops. We typically hold it on the second Thursday of each month. You can register to get on the invite list as well as view previous Shop Talks by going to shoptalk.info. Again, that's shoptalk.info. info, I-N-F-O, not shoptalk.com, but shoptalk.info. But to get back on the subject of P3s, one of my biggest takeaways from this conversation had to do with what has happened since the pandemic. The number of these deals have gone down significantly, but the size of the deals have, in a lot of cases, began to triple. Also, the universities are really looking to utilize P3s from developers that, you know, not just to solve their housing needs, but to also solve things like infrastructure projects and other non-residential buildings. And I got to tell you, the P3 space has always been really innovative, but where they are at now and where they are headed over the next 5 to 10 years is really going to require a lot of innovation. And so it's really cool to see how that side of our industry is evolving. All right, let's get to the segment. I'm not going to introduce these folks because they introduced themselves and their companies at the opening, but these guys are legit and they've done a ton of P3 projects over the past 2 decades. So let's give that a listen now. Back in the November, December issue of the Student Housing Business magazine, there was an article in there called The Value of P3s. And same time in November, the Brailsford and Dunleavy released their annual State of the Industry report on housing, which it's all housing that's, or all P3s, I should say, that is anchored by student housing. And it analyzed the projects that reached a financial close in 2022. The report included some trends that on the surface would indicate a pullback of the use of P3s, I would say, but that's not really necessarily the case. But we've got a great panel here today that have been involved for many of those deals that happened in 22 and can give us a little bit of an outlook as to what we should expect in the P3 world in the next few years. So I'm going to let them introduce themselves. Brad, we'll start with you.
Great. Thanks, Wes. Not sure I can match the energy of the last session, but I'll try. good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are. I'm Brad Shaw with Graystar. And a little bit about Graystar's P3 portfolio. We have a total of 26,000 P3 beds at 25 colleges and universities across the country. Many of these partnerships are 10 plus years in running, so we're pretty excited about our long-term partnerships that we have. Right now, we're working on three third-party P3s, that's hard to say, at the University of Washington, University of Hawaii, and Napa Valley College in Napa, as well as exploring several additional and second phases at several of our owned projects across the country.
Napa, you got an interesting list there, Brad.
That's a fun one. It's a 2-year school with currently has no housing. And so with the introduction of River Trail Village, they will be transforming that campus.
Well, fantastic.
From 9 to 5 to 24 hour.
Gotcha. Jason.
I think the real question for Brad is how often does he get to fly between Honolulu and Napa? Because it's not a bad, bad deal, Brad. Hi, Wes. Thanks so much for having me. I'm Jason Taylor, Managing Partner of Public-Private Partnerships at the Annex Group. Got about 20 years of experience in this industry and have personally been involved in about 35 transactions, P3 transactions, totaling just under $3 billion of project value. At the Annex Group, we're an impact housing developer. We've got about 3,000 beds of student housing that we've developed and manage, and including P3s at National Park College, at University of Louisiana Monroe, and one that we're really proud of that I hope to announce that we're closing this summer at the University of Memphis.
Good deal. Hey guys, Jeremy Doss, Senior Vice President at RISE. I've actually been with RISE since I interned with them here back in the summer of 2001. So since then,
wow,
I have looking back at the numbers, looks like I have been involved or led 41 of our 100 P3 projects and about 27,000 beds at the 58,000 and about half of the value, $4 billion total value at Rise P3s, and $2 billion personally of those. So awesome. I've seen it evolve a lot over the years.
Well, fantastic. Well, hey, I want to get into from that BND State of the Industry report. I want to get into that first and talk a little bit about the trends of these deals. You can see there in the first 6 years, 2014 through 2019, you know, you're averaging, I think I averaged it out, it was 20 odd, you know, that were happening, 26 maybe that were happening each year on average. And obviously the deal amount was much smaller than, you know, what we've seen specifically the past couple of years. But you could see what happened in 2020 with the onset of the pandemic. A lot of things got shelved. A lot of things, you know, were in limbo, obviously. 2021, a big comeback. You've got 21 that happened. You know, you would look at this and think, okay, coming into 2022, you've probably, you know, you're probably going to stay on par with what happened in 2021. And that didn't happen. We only had 10. We had half of what we had before. And so on the surface, I think that's a little concerning. But the question that, you know, I've got for you guys, going back to 2020 and the number of deals that were out there being discussed in 2019 and 2020 that ended up going into that limbo status, you know, is that something that is, are any of those deals still, you know, on the shelf waiting to be discussed? And if so, you know, is it more capital concerns, or is it more enrollment concerns, or maybe even a little bit of both that's holding those back?
I'd mute it. I'll jump in real quick. I think it's a combination of all. You know, 20, we were off and had a lot in the queue, and obviously COVID threw it off and everyone just stalled and paused and said, okay, well, what happens now? Some folks really, you know, it was a hard stop or hard pause, didn't get back going quick enough to be in the queue in 21. We were fortunate enough to get a project locked in with GMP and under construction and closed in early 21 before all that supply chain cost increase came that really stalled 22 deals. And then the 23 deals, the 22s were getting going. We had the new deals, but here came interest rates. So the ones that got through in 23 broke the formula, found the formula, and there are several, you know, that are queued up, ready to go, waiting for to find their path of least resistance and formula. So yeah, I mean, each one individual parameters and a story of their own.
Yeah, and just to interject one point, BND did say at the time of this report that they were still tracking 55 projects, and for 2023, 25%, so about 14 of those had started. So that's some input on or insight into 2023.
So I was just going to add, Wes, I think enrollment plays a really big role in whether or not universities decide to move forward, whether they've had conversations pre-pandemic and then maybe shelved it. I think if you look at the awards, the partnerships that were awarded last year, they were all at flagship or land grant institutions with increased enrollment. But that doesn't hold true for all land grant and flagship institutions. According to the Chronicle, there was an article recently in the Chronicle of Education about states that are experiencing growth, and those that have flat or declining population growth are not seeing increased enrollment at their institutions. So I'm a little worried that the smaller regional campuses may not be able to move forward with P3 plans that they've been working on previously.
Jason, any input on those 2020 deals?
Yeah, I mean, I think, Wes, it's, you know, I think Jeremy and Brad have sort of covered it. At the end of the day, there's, as BND noted in their report, there are plenty of deals that are kind of hanging out, whether it's some combination of taking a look at enrollment, as Brad rightly points out, whether it's being focused on cost of capital. And I think we're going to talk later about how many deals have converted to university credit deals as a function of that. I think there's plenty of campuses that are sitting back, waiting, hoping to grow enrollment. And, you know, connecting to the prior conversation, Wes, look at the amount of supply in certain off-campus markets. I think, you know, as rents have accelerated among purpose-built student housing off-campus, And, you know, we've seen double digit increases in plenty of those flagship markets, flagship public school, you know, markets over the last year or two, which have allowed many purpose built projects to go forward. We're also seeing plenty of markets where there's just significant supply right there. Today, there's about 8,000 beds of purpose built housing in Madison, Wisconsin. If we fast forward a few months, it'll be nearly 11,000. That's a pretty big shock to the system, right? To absorb that many beds at those types of rents. And I think a lot of campuses are sitting back and looking at what's going on off campus as well to understand what the picture looks like.
So I want to talk about another stat that was mentioned in that report. And that was, you know, coming from a survey that P3EDU, which is a conference that I think is held in Colorado each year, along with the Chronicle of Higher Education, did a survey of their university leadership that were attending. I think they were supposed to be attending this and this particular conference. And 75% said that they are going to be increasing P3s on campus, 23 staying the same, only 2% are looking to decrease it. But that question was a little bit, there was more to it. So I dug into it a little bit more to kind of really see what the question was, what the survey was, and it was really all encompassing of P3s. And so here from the 2023 survey, student housing made up 20% from those respondents that are looking for P3 deals. That's where student housing ranked. So I went back and looked at it at 2019, and you can see that in 2019, it was at 39%. Now there's some things on here, you know, if you go back and look at this one from 2023, artificial intelligence is on here. That wasn't even on there in 2019. There's also things like workforce development and employee training. That's number one now. And, you know, if we go back to 2019, I don't know exactly where this would fit, maybe the skills training and boot camp, you know, but number one was development of campus facility and infrastructure. So, and we'll have these on our website, probably in another day or so, and folks can take a look at that. But curious, are universities approaching housing P3 partners or traditional housing P3 partners, such as yourselves, about developing these non-housing projects?
Yeah, Wes, I think one of the top level answer is yes. I think what's interesting is if you kind of go back and look at that comparative data in 2019, campus housing infrastructure, campus facility infrastructure was up over 50%, right? And if we come over and look at 2023, I think energy is at 24%. So in 2023 or 24, would we look at a university and ask, gee, are you no longer committed to energy, sustainability, decarbonization of your energy infrastructure? Or do you simply look at it more as a way that you operate and the way that you operate your institution? You know, I happened to attend P3.edu last year, and I, you know, the conversations that I had were highly focused on student housing and the idea of leveraging and using student housing, both in terms of replacement and new beds. You know, I think the good news here, I think, is that it doesn't seem like a new asset class to many of our, you know, CFOs and others on university campuses. It's accepted as something that we do. I think that's highlighted by Brad and his colleagues, you know, working at University of Washington, Seattle. You know, Jeremy, if we go back to the 2000 aughts, which, you know, when we got into this business, there was no way that the University of Washington, or you got your project with RISE over at UT Knoxville, or a project I worked on with ACC at University of Michigan, those are three schools that wouldn't have come out of our mouths, right? And so I think that to me, it's really reflective of the acceptance of P3 and campus housing, and it's not really new and innovative. It's just what folks are doing as a function of the way that their universities operate.
Yeah, this bundling of options, I think, is the university wanting more bang for their buck. You know, we have two projects that involve childcare, and a few years ago, that would be unheard of as well. So I'm not sure if that's a trend, but, you know, two projects out of a fairly good sized portfolio is an interesting number.
Yeah. Jeremy, how about with you guys?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think we've always, you know, revenue projects, doing a P3, whether that be a dining hall, a parking deck, those were really seamless additions onto a kind of a core student housing project. But we've also kind of had smaller retail outlets, auxiliary, you know, spaces and such. So I think it's been done, but it's getting to mainstream. You know, back in the 2000s, we were going in and had to sell the P3 process. At the time, it was privatization. Why would you do it? What does it mean? We're finally past the point where, okay, we don't have to each go in and say, okay, what do you guys do? It's more about, hey, we kind of understand this. We've just got to go. We've got to pick our partner and roll on. So it just makes, you know, I think the whole industry as a whole will be better, more, and add more value, because really the speed to market is one of the top values that a P3 can provide a campus. Gotcha. And that's on pursuit of housing or any of these auxiliary functions.
Gotcha. I want to move over to, we've got a couple of questions coming in. I'll bring those up here in a second, but I want to move over to, you know, talking about the financial structure trends that we're seeing with P3s. And, you know, for the majority of my 27 year career in this industry, everything's been done with the typical 501c3 foundation. At least, you know, from my observation, that seemed to be, you know, the most of it. And it's funny to call something traditional. You remember seeing the first 501c3 deal that came out of the ground in that format. But again, as you look at this graph that was provided on the BND report, 10 again was the only number that we had, or the only number of deals that closed last year. But half of those were done on university credit. And I know in the prelim call, I think we discussed a little bit, I don't remember a time, and I've never been, you know, directly involved until the operations side on a P3. So I never remember university credit being, you know, spoken about as an option even. So is this something that, you know, we think we're going to see a trend on? Is this increase in utilization of university credit, is that mainly due to higher interest rates, or something else changed that's making that more attractive? And then the second part of that is, how do you see these structures evolving over the next 5 to 10 years?
I'll jump in real quick. I mean, I think the cost of capital, the cost of the escalation we've seen pretty much in the P3, the turnkey approach. We've got design, we've got concurrent pricing. We're running models on financing. We're finding the path of least resistance. Sometimes that path of least resistance, when interest rates spike, but the university partner does not want to dial it back down enough to get it financed on a project finance basis. Finally, the path of least resistance may be to bring in just enough support to get it across in a lower cost of capital. If you can lower it 100 basis points. So we're in real time, we're offering a look at and saying, let's find the best value at this moment in time. And so I think that's where we've seen, particularly in 22, most of those deals that got done because interest rates and costs were up were from university credit. Now the interest rates are coming back down. We just closed 2,000 beds at University of Tennessee. We're able to get it done in a project finance basis. But if we would have closed in September, we would have been 100 basis points higher. So it was really a timing thing there. But I think that's what's controlling that model.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I mean, gotcha. Jim, there's no question, right? I'm going to sound like a broken record because we've been on all the same panels together. There's only four things that make a deal work, whether it's a P3 or not, right? On a project-based basis, it's your rents, your cost of construction, your operating costs, and your cost of capital. What we know is that our operating costs have gone up. It costs more to hire people and retain them. Materials cost more. We know that our construction costs have gone up. We probably all lose our hair if we went about, you know, talking about that for the next few minutes. We know that every university wants to keep their rents at a place that they're attainable and affordable for their students. And so you look at cost of capital, and yeah, to Jeremy's point, we're in an environment where we're 100 basis points lower now than we were, you know, last year. And last year we were virtually 200 basis points higher than we were a year before that, right? So we haven't gotten it all back. And I think what a lot of institutions have decided is that they simply need those beds for whatever reasons. and they're willing to lend their credit in order to realize them. And, you know, the good news is there's a lot of creative structures that we can use that only use university credit support for a temporary amount of time and maybe not for, you know, the entire duration of a 30 or 35 year bond financing. But I think the extent to which universities can lend credit support in order to get deals done, you know, has really grown. I think it's just natural how many universities want to charge their students, you know, rents that they're going to have to escalate by double digits over years. You know, we certainly, our colleagues can get away with it off campus because it's simply supply and demand. But obviously there are other, especially at public institutions, considerations. And so many of them have just made the choice that what they can control is cost of capital. And so they will. I do think we're going to see that trend evolve. I also think what I just mentioned, the idea that you can find a way to use university credit and have that credit support burn off over some period of time is going to be one of the changes that we see over the next few years to help universities be able to create that housing at those rents that are affordable for their students.
Gotcha. Jeremy, I know you've got to run, and appreciate you staying on. And Brad and Jason, you got just a couple more minutes. Maybe we can get into some of these questions.
Sure.
Great. So one thing I wanted to ask, you know, in this situation where a university is using, you know, their credit, what's the eventual, you know, hope of that? Is that going to be something long term? Is that something that's short term to get, you know, get things off the ground and they're going to do, you know, some type of recap later down the road? Or what exactly, you know, is that a temporary thing just to get, you know, get a project off the ground?
Yeah, I think Wes is probably, and Brad, you feel free to jump in. I think it's a combination of things, not the least of which is certainly, you know, and I'll give the disclaimer, I'm no auditor and I'm no SEC certified financial advisor. But at the end of the day, what we're seeing is that the auditors are being more strict about what they view as on the balance sheet of institutions. The credit rating agencies are being stricter about what they view as being a capital obligation of the institution. And in some respects, unless you can do it as arm's length as possible from the institution, any little thing that you might do to lend some, what I'll refer to as demand support from the project, effectively brings that back into the peril of having higher impact on credit and balance sheet. And so for a lot of institutions, they've simply made the choice that we may as well just lend our credit and truly get a lower interest rate, turn down that cost of capital, and allow the project to move forward, versus some of the, you know, art and science, if you will, of trying to be arm's length while also trying to lend operational or other supports.
And I would just add, I think the level of control that the university partner wants on the project from start to finish really plays an important role in determining the best path forward in terms of financing.
So I've got to ask a question, because I've been in enough of these meetings with university administrators. Is there, in thinking about that risk factor, is there a particular background, you know, if you're sitting down with a CFO and you're laying out these, you know, here are these possibilities, is there a background that they're a little bit more, they're like, yeah, let's go ahead and get this done, you know, that lends to that, you know, maybe they've come out of the private sector or something like that? Or does it just really have to do more with need? You know, the immediate need.
Brad, feel free.
Well, I've experienced both. So the CFOs and the decision makers at the table have a real estate background. And so the economics of the deal are the most important aspect of it. And then on the flip side of that, you may have the housing folks and the student affairs folks who are really battling a need for additional beds and really looking to get a program built quickly so that they can relieve some of the stress that they're having in terms of a housing shortage.
Gotcha.
Yeah,
gotcha.
And I think, Wes, part of the answer is we've gotten better on our side of the industry at how we deliver, and certainly Brad and his group are a great example of how to operate alongside a university. You know, you talk about balancing that risk and what's inherent in that and what universities don't want to give up. We've gotten really good about providing that value as operators and as third-party partners to universities. And the other piece is certainly as more institutions, I mean, look at how many deals have been done in the past 9 years, right? From 2014 forward, as more institutions have gotten more exposure to P3, and we've gotten better as partners at delivering and operating those P3s. I think a lot of the concerns of, you know, Brad, when you and I would sit around, you know, 6, 7, 8 years ago, a lot of those concerns are just gone because we've done it. We've done it very well. And you add on that so many institutions have presidents or CFOs who've come from the private sector and are maybe a little bit more sophisticated in the way they think about how to use their real estate.
Yeah. So a question from the audience. This is from Eric Kiosky Smith. 22 deal value, and I'll bring that slide back up. 22 deal value was higher than any prior year other than 21. Details on that. Let me go back to that slide.
Yeah, I mean, I'll jump in here. I think that the biggest part of the answer, and we certainly saw it in 22 was, I think, 105 million. 21 was 177 million. Yeah, I think we're seeing the deals get larger, one, in terms of number of beds. Two, I think we're seeing more deals that look like less efficient buildings from a pure real estate perspective, which is to say with a lot more unrentable square space that universities need to provide their programs. We're seeing more freshman and sophomore housing, for example, that's being done in P3s. The other piece of that is I think that we're seeing larger deals in terms of by number of beds, right? So think about three deals that Brad into the thousands of beds that Brad and his colleagues are doing at University of Washington, 2,000 beds that that Jeremy and his colleagues just closed at University of Knoxville, 2,300 beds that my colleagues at ACC closed last year at University of Michigan. I think we're just, and the bulk of those not being relatively efficient apartment units, but being incredibly inefficient, freshman, sophomore suite and other types of units, semi-suite and traditional units. So I think it's just an evolution of the product type, the size of the deals, and what we're seeing in construction costs.
Gotcha. So one last question that I've got, and a lot of the research that I was reading about it, preparing for this, there was a lot of discussion going back to the financing structure part of it about getting credits from Inflation Reduction Act. Is that something you guys are having more and more conversations about?
I don't know if you want to take that one.
I can't. No, that's a tough one for me to take.
Yeah, I think it's a tough one for all of us. The answer is there's one deal out there right now. I think our colleagues at Balfour Beatty are executing at the College of William and Mary, and that's going to be the real guinea pig, right? The issue is most of the time when we're talking about tax credits, you have to have something, taxes that you're paying to credit it against. And so if we're talking about a taxes and bond financing, or if we're talking about an equity financing at an institution that because of the P3 enabling laws in that state doesn't have to pay property taxes, then you know you sort of turn around and go, what's the purpose of when you get tax credits when you're not paying taxes? There are some incentive programs like the 45L program under the Inflation Reduction Act, which are inherent in purpose-built sort of on-campus student housing, right? Whether it be Energy Star compliancy or other sorts of environmental and decarbonization and efficiency, they're inherent in everything that we deliver and have been for years. The question is, where can you actually apply those credits and those incentives? What I understand is that it's typically applied and you're able to realize those credits, unlike, for example, affordable housing tax credits or historic tax credits, where you can realize those tax credits during development. You're typically realizing those credits when you're actually operating and getting approval for those credits when you're actually operating and open. And so I think we'll be looking at William and Mary and others to determine whether and how the conditions exist that we might use those tax credits and how we can actually use them in an underwrite to make a project more economically feasible.
Well, it should be interesting to see. It doesn't, you know, we can't patent these financial structures. So it's pretty interesting to see.
We all get to see everyone else's stuff, Wes. That's the fun part.
Yeah, you just got to count how many arrows the developer has in their back when they when they get done with it. So, well, guys, thanks so much for being a part of this discussion. I could probably go another 20 minutes asking you guys questions, but this is an hour long show and we've gone over 10 minutes already. So, thanks so much for giving the extra time, and I'm sure I'll probably see both of you guys at Interface, but if not, thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Wes. Good seeing you, Brad.
You too, Jason.
Again, Again, a big thanks to Jeremy, Jason, and Brad for their time. Don't forget, you can join us each month live for our Shop Talk webinars by going to shoptalk.info and click on the registration link. Well, that does it for this episode. Thank you again for listening. And if you got any value out of it, please share it with your colleagues. If you catch this episode prior to the Interface Student Housing Conference in Austin, Texas, I'd love to meet up with you and talk about what you are doing in the student housing space. My email is in the show notes, so please send me a note and let's arrange a time to meet. Last but certainly not least, a big thanks to the Guarantors for being the sponsor for this episode. If you are not using a rent guarantee product for your property or across your portfolio, get in touch with them and have them provide an analysis. The link is in the show notes, or you can visit them at theguarantors.com/student. We also, just prior to this episode, completed a Behind the Biz episode of the Guarantors. So we get into the folks who are on the student housing side and everything that they're doing to support the student housing industry. So go check that out as well. Well, guys, thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.